This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last month, a 16-year-old girl called a family violence shelter in Texas to report she'd been beaten and sexually abused by a 50-year-old man who she said was her husband. The call triggered last week's raid on what members of the Fundamentalist Church of Latter-day Saints call their temple. Authorities took more than 400 children from the facility, and more than 100 women left the compound voluntarily. The sect practices plural marriage, polygamy, and its leader, Warren Jeffs, is currently in prison after a celebrated trial last year in Utah, where he was convicted as an accomplice to rape for arranging the marriage of a 14-year-old girl to her cousin. Earlier today, the search ended in El Dorado, Texas, and while the investigation continues, officials have yet to find the girl who made the call. If you want to know more about this story, or if you or your family's been involved in plural marriage, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also tell us your story on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. We begin with John McCormick. He's a reporter with the San Antonio News Express, and he's been covering the FLDS since the group established itself in Texas 4 years ago. He joins us now from San Antonio. Nice to have you on the program today.
Hello, Neil.
And can you give us an update? I understand there was more investigations today.
Well, as you suggested, the search has ended. And at this point, you have 416 children in state custody. And the next big development will be the very long and complicated legal process where the state tries to take custody of these children, separate the parental rights of their parents.
And as I understand, they're having some difficulty identifying who their parents are.
Well, I don't think anyone in this group is cooperating with the authorities. I think most of them would probably go back if they had a choice. So I think the officials are going to have a very difficult time prosecuting these cases in a conventional manner.
Mm-hmm. And what charges are being contemplated?
Well, the state has kind of made us extrapolated the complaint of a 16-year-old girl to the entire population of children out there, and it's a sweeping position that every child who grows up there is either been subjected to child abuse or would be in imminent danger of it. So it's a very broad position to take, and it's going to be difficult legally, I think, to convince juries of that.
Other than that one phone call, what evidence of abuse do they have?
Well, the FLDS is not new to a lot of people. It's widely known that there's arranged marriages of underage girls to older men, and there's a long pattern of what would conventionally be considered child abuse and even sexual abuse in the sect. So the state's on very firm ground as to what happens within the sect, but whether they'll be able to prove it and whether they'll have willing cooperation from the children is another matter entirely.
Tell us, have you been to this place? What does it look like?
I've been to El Dorado since the first news broke back in March of 2004 that the polygamists had come, and it was like a Martian landing. I mean, the people were absolutely terrified and repulsed, and at the time it was just a large ranch with a few buildings. Now it's got more than 100 buildings and a very large white temple, which I'm sure everyone's seen on television.
Mm-hmm.
And they're about six or seven miles northeast of town. They have kept to themselves over the last 4 years, and it kind of evolved an uneasy truce between the townspeople whose fears never came to pass, and the polygamists who stayed to themselves and did business in San Angelo, which is to the north. So they were rarely seen in El Dorado. So the thing had kind of quieted down after the initial panic.
And when you say they have this ranch, do they raise cattle, do they raise crops?
Well, they're entirely self-sufficient. I mean, not entirely, but they have dairy, they have orchards, they have gardens, they raise, you know, chickens. They're extremely hardworking, extremely frugal, and extremely self-reliant. So they almost never came to town in El Dorado. They went to, you know, when they had to buy things, they'd buy them in San Angelo. But they're very, very, it was a closed society, and the adult men were the only ones seen in El Dorado. Presumably some of the women and children appeared in San Angelo, but they were pretty much just over the hill and out of sight.
And they have yet to find the girl who made the call?
Yeah, and that's not really a surprise because apparently she was confronted in the midst of making one of the calls, and this would have happened a week ago Monday when the calls were made. So my assumption is that she's long gone from that place, and she might be at any of the other outposts, whether it's in so-called Short Creek in Arizona and Utah, or whether it's in British Columbia. There's a lot of places to hide her. And historically, people who have spoken out or complained have, or have tried to escape, have tended to be moved around and even disappear for extended times in this group.
We're talking with reporter John McCormick of the San Antonio News Express. If you'd like to join the conversation again, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Cheryl is on the line with us from Jacksonville in Florida.
Hello.
Hi, Cheryl. Go ahead, please.
Well, one of the questions I had is that it's my understanding that the authorities were well aware of the underage marriages and the situation that was happening, you know, on this compound and in other ones, you know, across other states. Why did they wait until this particular call came in to take any action?
I can answer that. It was raised at the press conferences last week in El Dorado, and it sounds like a technical answer, but in fact, it's the right position the state took. There's no secret that underage marriages, coerced marriages, take place within the sect, but as the Child Protective Services people pointed out, without a complaint, you can't just kick in the door and say, you know, we're taking your children. And as soon as they got a complaint, they acted in an overwhelming fashion. So it's kind of hard to understand, but you can't, you know, America's a country with people have a lot of rights regardless of their beliefs, and the state was not in a position just to make a let's see what's going on invasion of that place without a specific complaint from this girl.
I see. Well, it's also my understanding that at least, you know, the situation in Colorado City, you know, a lot of the authorities are actually part of this sect. Is that the case in
Texas? Well, that's very much
the
case. I went to Colorado City in 2004, and it's the police, you know, were the town police were members of the sect, and there was no local law enforcement at the time. Since then, the pressure on the community in Colorado City and Hilldale has increased significantly, and the Arizona folks have put a outside police officer there. So it's changed a lot in 4 years, which is probably why they came to Texas, because the heat was on.
John McCormick, I think she was asking, were there similar kinds of situations in El Dorado where the members of the sect were also the local police?
Yeah, not in El Dorado. In El Dorado, they lived over the hill, and the local sheriff is to be commended because he took a non-confrontational approach with them. He went out there and got to know them. He told them exactly what the laws were in Texas about sexual relations with underage girls, and he laid it out for him, and he maintained a dialogue and a rapport. And frankly, the fact that there wasn't any violence when the police went in last week is probably largely attributable to his, establishing this at least a basic level of trust with the elders of the group.
Cheryl, thanks very much.
All right, I just wanted to add one more thing before I go.
Very quickly, if you would.
Sure. Anybody who wants to know more about this group, you know, kind of countrywide and even, you know, the ones in Canada, there's a book out there called Under the Banner of Heaven by John Krakauer.
I've not read it, but thanks for the recommendation.
Yeah, wonderful book. Thank you.
Bye-bye, Cheryl. Let's go now to Ed. Ed's calling us from Philadelphia.
Hello. I don't conduct the alleged crimes here. I do question the authenticity of the probable cause used to conduct raid and to disrupt hundreds of people's lives. Since this was apparently a 911 call, have any reporters done any investigative research on the E911 records to verify that indeed a cellular phone call was made from within that compound?
Is there any suggestion that this was a setup, I think, is the
thrust? Well, yeah, it's not unusual for police to...
I understand. Let's get an answer.
Well, in answer to the caller's question, I don't know if anyone's traced the 911 call, but I think there's confidence that this was a real call. Beyond that, we're taking the state's word for it that they didn't just invent this call to charge in there.
So reporters are just taking the word of the government that this call indeed did originate from this compound.
A lot of what work reporters do is based on assessment of credibility, and in this case, the reporters, if faced with the choice, did the authorities make this up or did the call occur?
Did the E911 records, the call logs and the location records to indicate, to just to verify that this indeed happened?
You know, I don't even know what E911 records are. I'm sorry, I can't answer that.
Okay, Ed, thanks very much. Let's see if we can go now to Mike calling from Philadelphia.
Yeah, Philadelphia's representing today. I just I actually worked in the E911 industry. It's called Time Difference of Arrival. It's on cellular sites. I actually build cell sites and did installations in Connecticut and New York City on this. But anyway, I wanted to try to parallel this with the Branch Davidians and David Koresh and how you know, you talked about the violence and how it was nonviolent with the police going in there and taking kids into social services. Could you speak to that?
Yeah, were there any parallels to the raid on Waco?
Oh, yeah. I just coincidentally, I'm an old reporter, and I covered that one as well, which was in 1993 outside of Waco. And there's general parallels, but as you can see from the outcome, the parallels ended very quickly. The authorities here acted a lot more astutely. Apparently, they didn't charge in a cattle car full of commandos, and they managed to, serve the search warrants and without anyone getting hurt or shot. Once again, I think a lot of credit goes to the local sheriff. The parallels beyond that are general, but they're not certain. I mean, you had two so-called sects. There was issues of child abuse or alleged child abuse in each instance. Just how it obviously unfolded in entirely a different way. You had 160 people die in Waco. That was a federal action, which a lot of people are quick to point out in Texas, and this was a state action.
Hmm. Mike, thank you.
Okay.
And John McCormick, we appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
John McCormick, a reporter with the San Antonio Express News, with us from radio station WOAI in San Antonio, Texas. We're talking today about the raid on a compound in West Texas on a polygamous sect, 400 children, more than that, taken into protective custody. We'll talk more about religion and polygamy in America in just a moment. If you have questions about these sects or experience with them, we'll take your calls, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This week, authorities removed almost 400 children, more than that, from the Fundamentalist Church of Latter-day Saints in El Dorado, Texas, as women and children were loaded onto buses. Many sang religious hymns. Most of them have been isolated from people outside their faith for their entire lives. Joining us now is Ken Driggs, an Atlanta defense attorney who's written extensively about the legal history of polygamous groups. If you'd like to know more about this story, or if by chance you or your family's been involved in plural marriage, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also tell us your story on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Ken Driggs, nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Glad to be with you.
And we've seen this kind of raid, maybe not quite on this scale, before. How does it – is this different or similar to previous incidents, do you think?
It's just striking how similar it is to the 1953 Short Creek raid. At that point, the raid then culminated in investigation by Arizona authorities principally. And on July 27th, a force of well over 100 officers come into this very remote, very reclusive little desert community called Short Creek. At the time, there weren't even paved roads that connected it. And it was almost completely an outpost for fundamentalist Mormons. And the authorities seized every child, every woman, most of the men, although some teenage boys were not collected in that raid. And eventually, all of the women and children were released and went back to the community. The men who were prosecuted all pled to misdemeanors. They all went back to Short Creek and nothing changed. But that 1953 event has become just a central piece of their history and identity. And for those in the group who feel that the outside world is a hostile, unsympathetic place, it's become the thing they point to, and what you see here in Arizona, the allegations are almost the same. At least the results at this point appear to be the same. And I'm quite sure it reinforces those who are paranoid about the outside world.
Yeah, the same way we had a caller, and she's certainly not the only one who's questioned why authorities waited 4 years in Texas to do this. There are people who are also asking, wait a minute, isn't this religious persecution?
Well, I think the Texas authorities really overreacted. I think this was almost the complete wrong way to go about this. There has been a longstanding sort of debate within this religious community, and FLDS stands for Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, about how much they should be engaged with the outside world. And when Warren Jeffs became the leader of the group with the death of his father in 2002, and he effectively was leading it in 1998 when he came back down there and started acting in behalf of his father, who was pretty infirm, he fell down on the side of those who thought they should not be engaged with the outside world, that they should withdraw more and more. And that came at the time they were having some legal pressures that weren't necessarily criminal but had to do with other issues in Short Creek. And I believe one of your earlier commenters, the reporter, indicated that the move to Texas had something to do with that. And I really agree with that. So the people who moved to Texas with him, I believe, are the most hardcore, the most devout followers of Warren Jeffs, and just got more reclusive. And so I see this event as pushing them further in that direction. And I don't think Warren Jeffs' imprisonment is going to alter that push one way or another.
I was just going to ask that. He is in prison serving, I guess, two terms for 5 years to life. I guess he faces still more charges, too. But
yes, he is.
Is he still the prophet, the leader of this group?
I haven't seen any indication that he is not still regarded as the prophet and leader of the group. In the course of his trial in Utah, I think it was last September, he said some things. There were some notes he tried to pass to the judge, and there were some recordings of meetings he was having at the jail with one of his brothers where he indicated that he was a false prophet and he had sort of maneuvered his way into the role and that the people shouldn't follow him. And then after the trial's over, he completely retrenched from that and still asserts his role as prophet and leader of the community. But when you're not physically there, I mean, obviously there are a lot of things that you can't do. I'm not real clear on who his new lieutenants are. I know when he took over from his father shortly after that, he effectively excommunicated or kicked out many of the people who believe they should be engaged with the outside world, who tended to be a bit older than he was. I think he probably saw them as threats, and installed a whole new sort of leadership cadre, many of whom are people that I'm not real familiar with. I knew the old guard down there pretty well. So I'm not real clear on who's calling the shots right now.
Another thing that we've heard in the various news reports from El Dorado is that this supply of young girls, 14, 16 years mm-hmm. old, in a way that this is currency. This is what the leadership uses to reward loyal members. Is that a fair characterization?
I think that's a bit unfair. I mean, I think there's kind of an element of it. Let me just briefly indicate my background with the community. I first went in there out of curiosity in 1988, January of 88. Have been there many times. I've stayed with overnight with families. I've had dinner with their homes. I've played with their kids. I've gone to a lot of their church meetings. I'm aware of the fact that there were a lot of things I was not given any exposure to. But I had pretty good exposure to that community, and I knew Warren Jeffs a little bit. And some people explained to me that young men were expected to do what was called a work mission, where you go off and work somewhere at a job, and the community has a lot of building contractors in it, so you frequently were working with other fundamentalist Mormons. And you effectively turned your paycheck over to the church. It went into the church coffers. And when you had completed your work mission, you were deemed worthy and rewarded with a plot of land to build your home on in the community, and it was all owned by the United Effort Plan, their cooperative living entity, and a worthy wife. This would be young men who didn't have a wife. I mean, those would be arranged marriages as well. But it's also obvious that some of the other marriages with child brides or women under 18, I'll put it that way, were with men who were significantly older than they were. And that's what some recent prosecutions have involved.
Let's get a caller on the line and go to Michael. Michael with us from Russellville in Arkansas.
Hello.
Hi.
If I remember my history correctly, until the time that Utah wanted to become a state, polygamy was an official part of Mormonism, and it was only if they officially renounced it that they would be allowed to become a state. And because polygamy was illegal in the United States, I believe a federal law. My question is it not still a federal law? And if it was or is, why couldn't the authorities have gone in sooner in Texas, and what about other groups such as mm-hmm. Muslims that in the United States that allow polygamy?
Well, to explain the Utah historical thing, yes, it was a doctrine and teaching of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. In 1890, the president of the church issued something that Mormons call the Manifesto, basically discontinuing the practice. It really didn't end in 1890. It took a couple of generations for it to stop in the mainstream church. And when it did stop, Utah did gain statehood in 1896. And then the church started excommunicating these holdouts, these people who felt, no, this is God's law, you can't change this. And there were a lot of other issues besides polygamy. That wasn't the only thing, but it was sort of the thing the public knew the most. And as those people got thrown out of the big church, they began to form this parallel religious community that we now call fundamentalist Mormons. And the FLDS is one sliver of that parallel religious world.
And again, parallel. They have no connection to the LDS church in Utah.
There is no formal affiliation with the LDS church. They are clearly culturally close to the Mormon community, but they have no formal affiliation with the church. Mm-hmm. But to answer the legal question, well, Utah was a territory. Congress got to pass the laws. And when Congress said you can't do this, Congress had an anti-polygamy statute and an anti-cohabitation statute that unmarried people could not live together. And that's how most Mormons were prosecuted in the 1880s and that period. When Utah became a state, federal law doesn't reach anymore. Then it becomes a matter of state laws. And each state has their own laws about this. Then the United States Supreme Court a few years ago issued an opinion called Lawrence versus Texas that is frequently called the gay sex case. It had to do with sexual relations between consenting adults. And basically the Supreme Court said you can't criminalize that. And that also had the effect of reaching physical relationships between a husband and multiple wives. So in a sense, you couldn't criminalize polygamy. The only way it is criminalized is under a bigamy statute, and bigamy is a crime of fraud where wife number one doesn't know about wife number two or vice versa, and you've gone down to the courthouse and you've gotten a marriage license that you're not eligible for. You've sort of brought the state into this fraud and in the application process make representations that are not true. That law pretty much exists all around the country. But when you deal with consenting adults over the age of 18 who go to a religious leader or just go to themselves and say, hey, we're a family. We want to hold this out ourselves out as husband and wives. In the eyes of the law, you're just a couple of people shacking up together. You're just unmarried cohabitors. But that doesn't prevent you from seeing it another way and solemnizing it through a religious leader that you recognize, but the state is not going to recognize. And that's how these relationships are formed in this community. And they are protected. You cannot prosecute them. But when you have people under the age of 18, that's when you open yourself up to criminal prosecution. And that's what's going on with the FLDS people now.
So other religious groups would be exempt for the same reason?
Yep, for the same reason under Lawrence versus Texas, yeah.
Thank you.
We actually have a little polygamy here in Atlanta with Islamic people. So, I mean, it's not confined to fundamentalist Mormons by any means.
Thanks very much for the call, Michael.
Bye-bye.
And when we note that I think about 140 women left the compound voluntarily, should we assume that they have moved on to other FLDS compounds, or have they fled to safety elsewhere, do you think?
No. I mean, if you're talking about leaving voluntarily with the authorities, as I understand it, the state comes in and says, these are your kids, we're taking your kids. You can come along if you want. I think that's how most of those women left. I would not call that voluntary. That's sort of borderline kidnapping on the part of the state. And that is exactly what happened in the 1953 raid. A lot of mothers were taken out with their children to be with their children when they were in foster care in Arizona. If they've gotten their kids back, I suspect they may have gone on to another community. I'm just not quite sure where those people are without knowing the relationships, which in the media doesn't tell you, you know, how many women have children that are in that group. But that's my guess that that's what's going on.
And it's your experience and your reading of history that these raids like this tend to, well, consolidate people in their faith.
Oh, yes. They strengthen the hand of the leader who says, you are being persecuted for being a godly and righteous people. You are being persecuted because you're following God's law, and the people who are persecuting you are evil and not trustworthy. That's what they are frequently taught. And this just reinforces that message. And it undercuts the hand of those people in this religious community who have said, hey, we need to live with the outside world. We need to get along with them. We need to navigate the laws as best we can. Those people have been undercut dramatically by this raid.
We're talking with attorney Ken Driggs, who's written extensively about the legal history of polygamy and who's met Warren Jeffs and is familiar with the FLDS. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Jolene. Jolene with us from Jennings, Oklahoma.
Yeah, my question is, why are they marrying underage girls? I mean, why can't they marry girls over the age of 18?
I can guess a little bit. I think you have to ask them.
I know there are
other groups who have drawn a bright line on 18. Mm-hmm. They will not allow those marriages in their groups, and if you come to them wanting that, they'll say no, and if you still solemnize it, they'll kick you out. They're smart enough to know that this draws heat.
Yeah.
Among other things, also recognizing that, you know, there's a judgment issue.
Given that, this must be a matter of principle of some sort.
Well,
I think if I'm trying to read Warren Jeffs' brain, and I know Warren a little bit but not intimately, I think it becomes a kind of a test of faith with him and sort of a test with the outside world. It's his way of saying, I'm not going to be cowed. I'm not going to be dictated by you. I think that's part of it. Another part of it, I'm sure there are people who think that this is a way of keeping these young women in the community. Although I've certainly known people who have left. They don't put a gun to people's heads and make them stay. And I know people who've left and found the outside world pretty uncomfortable and came back. You don't hear about that much in the media. You get the story about all the escapees, but they don't tell you about the folks who find Las Vegas less than appealing and they come home to Colorado City. I think it's also kind of a culture. This is the way people have lived in this community for a long time, and even if they may find it a little difficult sometimes, it's what they know. I think all human beings are kind of like that. If you pull somebody out into another way of living, another kind of life that you're not familiar with navigating, that gets a little scary too. So sometimes you will stay with what you know, even though you may not be entirely comfortable with it.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like a control issue then, too.
I think there's a bit of that. Yeah, I'm not going to deny that there isn't some of that going on in here.
Yeah, because if you get a 14-year-old girl that hasn't known anything else, you know, you tell her this is the way it's got to be, and that's the way it's going to be, you know.
I think this business about 13 and 14-year-olds is much overplayed. I'm aware of a lot of 16-year-olds, occasionally 15-year-olds.
Well, still, that's
underage. No, I mean, it still is. I'm not saying it's not underage, but I think a lot of people like to pull the number down to make it look worse.
Yeah, well,
and I really think this 13, 14-year-old thing is pretty overstated.
Well, they said on the news this morning that a 16-year-old has already had four children. You know, so she's had to start young. I mean, really young.
That doesn't necessarily make her representative. I mean, I'm not denying that
happens.
No, I'm
not
saying
that either. You know, I'm just saying, you know, why did they have to have the younger ones like that?
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Jolene. Good question.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Uh-huh.
I think there was some supposition, perhaps naive, that the conviction of Warren Jeffs would lead to the weakening of this group, that it's diminution. Is there any indication of that?
Well, I think, one, I don't think it will weaken the group. It may end up strengthening the group. All these prosecutions in the past have never, and they had the goal of sort of exterminating them and making them go away, and they've never worked that way. In the long run, it may weaken Warren. I mean, if he ends up doing a very long prison term, and I think that's probably what's going to happen, I think he's going to find it pretty hard to continue to exert full leadership from inside. He's going to have to delegate, and if he doesn't, somebody else is going to come in and assert themselves and maybe take over. I'm already aware of some people kind of peeling off. This group has fractured a bit under Warren Jeffs. I know of at least two fairly sizable slices that have broken off and are either competing for other of Warren Jeffs' followers or just setting up a completely new group. There is another community right down the road from Short Creek called Centennial Park, which represents about a quarter of the people in Short Creek who broke away in the late 1990s in some disputes that had to do with Warren's father. So these groups are always sort of breaking up, splintering, but they don't go away.
Ken Driggs, thanks again for your time. We appreciate it.
Glad to be with you.
Ken Driggs, an attorney and an expert on the legal history of polygamy, joined us from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Coming up, if you're waiting to board a flight, get comfortable if you can. On another day of airline misery, we've got a guide to lessening your pain. Get a massage, finding fun, food, and losing your frustration in an airport. That's coming up next. If you'd like to join that conversation, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.